You're listening to Profiles in France Formation, the podcast where we hear from inspiring people who have pursued their dream of moving to France. We learn about why they moved, how they overcame the challenges they faced, and what they love and hate about living in France. I hope that hearing their stories can help you to pursue your dreams and maybe your very own France Formation. I'm your host, Allison Grant Luness, and I'm here to tell you, my guests followed their dreams, and you can follow yours too. It starts today. Welcome to episode 59 of Profiles in France Formation. I'm your host, Allison Grant Luness, and this week I'm speaking with Charlotte King, my friend, an art history and wine expert, and co-owner of two companies in France. Bacchus and Clio offers customized tours of France focusing on wine, gastronomy, and French history and culture, while her business Cura Consultants offers trainings on food and wine to professionals in the restaurant industry. Charlotte moved to France at the same time as me, and we sang in choirs together in Paris while she explored various careers, from teaching at the university level, to becoming an art history tour guide at the Louvre, to working as an interpreter in the wine department at Le Cordon Bleu, where she met her business partner. Welcome, Charlotte.
All right, so welcome. I'm so excited to have you today.
Thanks, Allison. I'm very excited to be here.
So why don't we start with, tell me about what gave you the idea to move to Paris and how did you get here?
Well, the first time I moved to France, I wasn't moving to Paris. I ended up moving to Burgundy for a year because I did a French study abroad program. So I lived with a host family in Burgundy for my senior year of high school. And that was how I got the French bug. That was an interesting experience, not living in Paris. This was at this point a very long time ago. And no one in Burgundy really spoke English. And I didn't speak any French. And it was a bit of a mess. I would say it took me a very long time to kind of find my place there. But that was kind of my first experience in France. And I guess by the time I finished that year, I spoke French relatively well. And then kind of went back to the States, went to college, studied abroad twice in France, and then went back to America for a year to live with a boyfriend in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He was great. Wisconsin didn't want to be there anymore. And so I ended up moving back to France back in 2011 and got a job in Paris as a teaching assistant at a university. So that's kind of when I sort of permanently moved to Paris because I was working at the Sorbonne Nouvelle and another university called Marne-la-Vallée, which is near Disneyland, in case no one has heard of Marne-la-Vallée. And, you know, had a lot of students who were Disney princesses, which was pretty awesome. You know, I had Ariel. She was in one of my classes. That was good. So yes, that is how I ended up moving to France. Is just basically I found jobs that would take me as a foreigner and worked at the universities for, you know, 5 years. And it was a great gig. I ended up getting out of teaching English and was instead teaching art history, theater history, American history, taught HTML for a semester. That was a questionable task to be given. So I was spending my time every night looking up HTML and was like, what am I supposed to do with these students? But they all made great websites at the end. It was more of a hands-on learning situation rather than learning from me, but it worked out.
That's how I learned HTML.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of how it's a trial and error situation. And I was like, you need to get your hands dirty in order to really understand this. You're not going to learn as much from me. But yeah, I mean, the university system in France has a giant lack of teachers. So they just kind of take whoever to teach certain things every once in a while. And I ended up in that situation. Art history and theater history were definitely more my jam. So yeah, and then a couple years in, I started to get bored of teaching. Just, I mean, I like change and I like doing new things. So I then got hired as an interpreter at the Cordon Bleu in their wine department. And that's really kind of where things got super interesting again, because I did not know a whole lot about wine. I thought I knew a bit about wine. Turns out I didn't. And so interpreting was quite the task because I was interpreting for, the best sommeliers of France, something called MOF, which are Meilleurs Ouvriers de France. So the best craftsmen of France. And, they're these titles that are really prestigious. And I'm interpreting for these sommeliers that have these titles. And I'm like, I don't know anything about one. So I had to learn really, really quickly, which was, it was a mountain. And after 6 months of interpreting for all these these people, I started getting really confident in it. And it was a really, really cool job. But like 6 hours a day interpreting is a lot. It's a mental jungle that you're like going in with a machete and cracking things down. So yeah, no, it was really fun though. And that was a great job. And that's actually where I met my business partner, Frank. He is a sommelier by profession. He's one of the best teaching sommeliers in the Paris region. A lot of his former students, you know, are head sommeliers at the Ritz and at all these palace hotels. And so he's extremely talented. And being under his wing, I just got to learn so much, got to meet a ton of really interesting winemakers, other sommeliers. And yeah, so that is how I ended up now in the wine industry / tourism / teaching / all of things.
Yeah, it's so funny because you're somebody that I know who we've known each other basically since we both first got here at around the same time. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But you've had so many different interesting jobs. And I think that, you know, you are a great piece of evidence that nothing that we do or learn about or like no job that we have is unrelated to whatever we end up doing. Like we sort of bring it all together in the end, regardless of how random that it seems, you know?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's really funny because I feel like most people I know that have, you know, college degrees are like, I don't do anything that has to do with my degree. And actually, you know, I have a degree in theater and French, and then I have a master's degree in translation. And I literally all three of my degrees every day in different capacities. I mean, you know, I'm also a tour guide. So theater is still a massive part of my life. I mean, I'm putting on a show every time I'm given a tour, right?
Absolutely.
And same thing when you're doing a wine tasting. I mean, you're trying to keep everybody entertained. And basically, you know, I use all those degrees. It's super funny in different ways. Turns out theater degrees actually are very beneficial for show jobs, you know?
Yeah, well, yeah, I bet. And I mean, I majored in French and I sarcastically used to tell people that I was going to speak French professionally as a job, but you know what? That's kind of what I do. So
yep. And
part of what I do.
Yeah, it's really great.
Yeah. So tell me about the two companies that you have now and what gave you the idea to start those. And then I want to talk to you a little bit about the challenges of setting up those companies and the fun bureaucracy that I am sure was involved.
Oh, it was very interesting. Yes. Well, essentially what happened is as I was working at the Cordon Bleu, after, you know, about 3-4 years working there, I started to get bored again. Turns out that is a theme in jobs for me. And basically my now business partner, but at the time he was, you know, the head of the wine department, I essentially planted a seed in his brain, which was like, maybe we should, because he was, you know, he had been there for like 8 years. He was kind of ready for a change as well. And planted the seed of being like, maybe we should start a company that brings our two worlds together. We're like, I have all of this like art history, theater history. I'm a certified national guide. You're this like awesome sommelier. You do wine. And I'm like, we literally have everything that everybody loves about France in a package, right? Between the two of us. So essentially, it planted that seed. And like a year in, he's like, you know, I remember you talking about maybe starting a business that's like in tourism and brings our worlds together. Like maybe we should start, you know, playing around with that. So that's kind of how that was born. It was planting a seed and then waiting for it to blossom into this beautiful rose. So that's how we got the idea. And then as we were kind of like working through business plans and all this, basically, I mean, I've been a tour guide since 2013. So, you know, I lived through a lot of weird moments in tourism. And I was like, tourism's not 100% stable all the time. So we should actually start two companies under one. I mean, basically, you know, I lived through like the 2015 terrorist attacks and then the Gilets Jaunes and like all of these different weird strikes. And so essentially I was kind of like, you know, tourism is unstable, even though it's great in France and it's the most visited country in the world. There are still moments that are a little frightening in that industry. And so we started Bacchus and Clio, which is our tourism company, and we started Kira Consultants, which is a wine for professionals company. So essentially we do, with Kira, we do training programs for people who are competing for titles. So Best Molly of the World, Best Molly of Europe. We also run events. We do wine selection. We source wine for people who are trying to start their cellars. We do training programs for restaurants. So we've had some really cool restaurants that we've been able to work with. Moulin Rouge was a big one. That was really neat. I have lots of things to say about the Moulin Rouge. I love them. They're very interesting because I had never really been to the Moulin Rouge. And turns out their staff, a lot of them have been there for like 25 years. Yeah. They actually don't have a wild turnover like a lot of other businesses in like the restaurant industry, because Moulin Rouge is also, you know, dinner and a show. So,
right.
Mm-hmm. And yes, it was just, it was a fascinating company to work with. And I just like learned so much about them, and I'd never really given it a big thought before. So yeah, that's what we do with Kira. And then Bacchus and Cleo, we do tourism for people who really want to discover what France is all about. So history, monuments, wine, gastronomy. And a lot of the stuff that we do is tailor-made to people who are coming to Paris and really want like an exceptional 3, 4, 8 days. We put together itineraries for them. Yeah. Hopefully that was clear enough. Yeah. That was a lot of things. But thankfully, you know, I mean, I'm really, really happy that we decided to do that right from the beginning, where we had two companies that could do two separate things, because we launched in November 2019.
So that was quite prescient and fortunate.
Yes, I mean, you know, starting 4 months before COVID hit and the entire country went on lockdown, good thing we did not rely on only tourism, because we had to pivot and basically became a certified organization to do training programs for professionals. And so we had, oh my gosh, that was admin everywhere. So, I mean, I know you do admin all the time, Allison, and like, I mean, I kind of do too, but like, man, it's dealing with French admin is just wild. So they have this thing in France. If you're going to be a certified FALMAC, you have to, which is like a training organization, right? You have to be certified by the state, like for all things, right? So we had to do this, like all of these audits about our training programs. It was like, you know, and Frank is a French guy who, I mean, he doesn't have to deal like with admin the way that others do. I mean, we do admin all the time. And so essentially I was like, we're just going to push through this. We're just going to do moral harassment until we get this stupid certification. And the certification is fantastic. I mean, the French government has done a really nice job. They're trying to make sure that people are actually give like qualified, decent training programs. So, I mean, I understand why you have to do it, you know, and it's good. Not just anybody can train people. So yeah, that was like 3 months of just lots and lots of paperwork. And I mean, my French is fine, but I definitely make Frank write everything. I tell him what to write. I do a lot of dictating. So like, no, you got to write it this way. Like, you know, make us sound really cool. And then they're going to give it the certification. So yeah, that was fun.
Fun. Yeah, because I think for being a certified like organisme de formation, you have to have like a defined curriculum with objectives and like present certain things in a way, and then you can't really deviate from that when you're doing your training. You know, you can't really change what you're doing in a way that somebody who has like a non-certified program might be able to like modify their course or their curriculum or provide certain things.
Yeah. So what's interesting is we're not a school. So we just do training programs. So what's actually really interesting is we do work in wine, right? There's only so many like pathways that you can learn about wine, right? I mean, there's tons of stuff to learn, but basically, I mean, we do modify all of our curriculums to be tailor-made for the restaurant or, you know, whatever organization we're doing these training programs for. So we actually can't. So weirdly, the way that they've done this like certification is that you have to adhere to 21 quality standards that don't necessarily have to do with your curriculum, but they have to do with like being inclusive and making sure that you're open to working with people that have handicaps or it's like, it's a huge list of basically a checklist that you have to go down. And yeah, so we got that certification and it has been fantastic to have, because that really saved us during COVID, because all the restaurants were closed. So what do you do with your staff when you're still paying them, but you're closed and you're not making any money, well, you can train your staff and have the state pay for it. So yeah, that's what saved us in COVID.
Oh, wow. That's brilliant.
Yeah. It worked out really, really well. It was the best pivot that we made. And now we're pivoting back into tourism because now the restaurants are open and they don't have time to do parent training programs. So now we're back working with a lot of tourists, which is also super, super rewarding because like tourists, when they come to France, it's so fun to work with them because they are either discovering France for the first time or are coming back for like the eighth time and get to discover something new. So you kind of have this like wide-eyed, bushy-tailed clientele, right? That's like very curious and exciting. And yeah, that's great too. So, I mean, all of what we do is just really fun and rewarding and all with teaching as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are some of the things that when people come to Paris, whether they've been here a lot of times or, you know, it's one of their first trips, what are some of the things that they really like to learn about or experience as an introduction to French wine and food? And how do you present that to them?
So I think one of the most complicated things about wine for, especially people coming from America, is that wine in France does not have the great variety written on the bottle. Right. And like in America, we're used to seeing bottles that are written like Pinot Noir, Merlot. And you kind of get this sense that you sort of know if you're opening the bottle, you know what you're kind of going to get. Right. Where in France, there are no grape varieties written on the bottle. It is assumed that when you buy a bottle, you already know the grape variety because you know what region it's coming from. So I think when we're doing like an introduction to wine tasting, this is like the big thing is we don't do it by grape variety. We do by region because every region in France is super different. And so you're just kind of learning like the basics of these different areas of France. And what's fun about that is all the areas also have different history. So you also have this kind of play where like, not only are you drinking a grape variety, you're also drinking, you know, 2000 years of grape growing history in every bottle of French. So it's really fun because there's a storytelling that happens with every bottle. Then you also have, you know, not only the regions that are specific, but also the winemakers. So, I mean, we work with all these winemakers that have, you know, crazy stories. You know, we work a lot with Yves Gangloff, who's a really phenomenal winemaker in the Rhone Valley, in the Northern Rhone specifically. And he's known as the rock star of the... So he has a group, obviously a rock group, that is called the Grateful Dead.
Oh my God, that is the best thing that I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's great. And like when you meet him, you're like, he really does look a little bit like an 80s rock star, but he makes some of the most delicious wine in the Northern Rhone. And yeah, so it's like, you know, it's those kinds of things where like when you're opening a bottle, it's not just wine, it's all these other things that are inside of it. And yeah, wow. So that's kind of what we do.
That's amazing.
I hope that answered your question.
It did. It answered many questions that I didn't even know that I had.
Yeah. It is. It's a funny thing. Like, you know, there's all these, the wine is just like such a weird bridge. People think that it seems, you know, it's really intimidating. There's all these like things that you're to know about it. But in the end, you're enjoying fermented grape juice in good company. Right. And like, that's really what is the most important thing in wine is that, sure, you feel like you're learning some things, but also, you know, drinking and having fun and like having a good laugh. Yeah. Basically storytelling. I mean, that's what we do over dinner, right? We drink wine, we tell stories and like tell a bunch of jokes. I mean, that's how I should learn about wine is doing that and not being too pretentious about it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's kind of how you have to learn. It's just trying a bunch of different things and trying them. I really enjoy when I can try whole wines and like taste them next to each other to see how different, because I'm not a very big drinker, but I don't necessarily like, you know from one time to the next, but, you know, the differences, or like, you feel like your palate isn't well developed and you're not like, there's something that you're missing and that you should be knowing more about it, but you don't.
In the end of it, I mean, you just need to enjoy it. So like, even if you know, if you don't have like the exact word that you want to like tannins, I mean, that's okay. You're not a wine professional. You don't need to do that. You need to know if you like it or not, right? And it's partially our job as well, is to kind of figure out what kinds of wine people like. And that way, you know, when we book a restaurant for them, we can already recommend something that we know that they'll like on a wine list.
Yeah. Well, and the interesting thing too, because I've started doing like a couple of wine tastings when I've gone to different areas of France to taste the different local wines that are produced. And in the spring, last spring, we were in the Loire Valley and we went to a wine tasting. My parents were visiting, so my mom came, and then a couple of our clients who live out there. And so, you know, they were describing all of these wines, and you can see like they have the map of the Loire and where all the different wines are produced. And they tell you about, okay, well, the grapes grow here. And like, there's this microclimate here, and you know, the sun falls on the hillside in this way here. And it's so interesting to learn about how that grows. But then also when they give you the wine, they say like, you know, first you taste the wines next to each other, and then you taste them with a cheese or with a piece of saucisson or something that they have selected to go with the wine, and it can make the wine taste completely different. And it's such an interesting experience to do it like that. And it's really one of the main things, I think, that learning about food and appreciating food in France is really about.
Well, what's really cool about, because I feel in the States, a lot of, you know, wine drinking is kind of like, oh, I'm just going to have a glass of wine, but you're not necessarily eating with it. Where in France, the tradition is, you're always going to be eating if you're drinking. I mean, this is kind of, you know, a French thing as well, as like, you don't want to seem drunk in front of people. So like, you need to obviously have soakage. So there's, you know, this really fun game to play around with food and wine pairings. And there's a lot of theory behind it. But the easiest thing in France for food and wine pairing is to look at regional pairings. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a cheese that's coming from the Loire, one of the Loire wines is probably going to go really great with it.
Yeah.
If you're eating, so like, let's take a really simple, everybody knows it, cheese, Camembert, right? So mm-hmm. I mean, Camembert coming from, you know, the Northeast of France, and there is no winemaking in the Northeast of France. So what do you pair with Camembert? What do they make in you know, Normandy and Brittany? Cider. Yeah. So like cider and Camembert works really, really well together. And it turns out Camembert with wine is actually, I mean, some people really love it, but it's kind of a hard sell for a lot of people. And so, yeah, cider works great. But if you're having, you know, let's say goat's cheese from the Loire Valley, well, I mean, what's going to go with that? You can grab a Sancerre, right? You can grab a Savinière. There's all these different, you know, wines that come from France that just pair with foods perfectly. And I love that about France, because you don't have to think too hard either. Like, people think it's going to be a science, but actually you can just do it super simple.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so interesting because it's such a great way to learn about all the different regions of France and the local cuisine. And one of the things that is really great about France, and that, I mean, I'm still learning every time I go somewhere new, and I haven't visited all of France yet, but it's when you go to a place, like everything is super local. Like your market vegetables are super local, like your cheeses are produced locally. I mean, you can get stuff from farther away, but it's not like France hasn't been homogenized. Like if you go to Toulouse, you're going to get saucisson de Toulouse, and you're going to get, you know, violet candies and violet products and things like that. If you go to Aix-en-Provence, it's all lavender, and you're going to get... And you're going to get different herbal cheeses with, and it's something that I really just in the past couple of years started to and learn about a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I really love about France is that it's a really, I mean, geographically, it's relatively small, right? I mean, it's kind of slightly bigger than Texas, right? And within that area, I mean, they have so many different types of climate. They have so many different traditions. I mean, literally you can come to France, you can be in France forever and not discover the entire thing. There's so much stuff in such a small, condensed space. And this is part of the reason why I really love working in wine and tourism and art, is because all of these things actually link up and come together and help you create this sort of like story about these areas. And it becomes really memorable because of that as well. I think like traveling through France, you can like remember how, you know, Provence smells because of all that lavender. But then you also remember, you know, eating, you know, certain regional cheeses or drinking regional wines, or you remember going to like the Bondol area in Provence and like, you know, sitting amongst all of these vines, and there's like lavender and bees everywhere, and you're like, oh my God, am I gonna get
stung, but at the same time, like, they're too busy with the lavender, so it's gonna be fine. And you're like drinking your rose, and there's a winemaker who's like in their boots and looking all muddy and talking about like amphoras and all sorts of weird vinification techniques. And you're like, I'm just kind of drinking this rosé, sitting next to my lavender and like having a great time. And you remember it because everything, there's like, it's literally all of your senses are stimulated constantly. And I think, you know, there's also, obviously it can be relaxing in Provence as well. Mm. But like, yeah, you just kind of have this sensation where you're seeing new things, you're smelling new things, you're hearing new things, and tasting new things. And it's just really rich and really rewarding. Because I mean, there's something as well that came up a lot in when we were starting our tourism company, which is, you know, the French have a particular view of tourism, which tends to be a little bit, it's like, oh, you go to the south of France and you sit on a beach, where a lot of the people that we get coming to France are really curious and they're really here to learn as well as to enjoy themselves, right? But it's a totally different ballgame. And Frank's loving it because he's like, I didn't realize that tourists could be so curious and like excited about France. Because of course, French people get less excited about France than most French people, right? Get less excited about France than foreigners. And it's kind of fun because like he's rediscovered a country as well. But yeah, no, I think it's, you're totally right. Like every region of France has a completely different identity. And it's really great when you start traveling around the country. I mean, I actually don't leave France that often because there is so much to learn here and there's so much to discover. And it is still, you know, even though I've become French, it is still a foreign country for me, right? And I still get really excited about it.
Yeah. And for me, I mean, I spent a lot of my earlier years in France. You know, I was a student and then I was starting my business. And so I didn't really have the budget. And when I was traveling, I was mostly going home to visit my family. And for me, one of the silver linings of COVID, one of the very positive things that I was able to do during that period, we took a big road trip in the summer of 2020. And we did all of like the south of France. We did Lyon, we did Grenoble, we did Aix-en-Provence, we did Cannes and Nice and all of these places that I had never had the opportunity to visit before and hadn't had the budget to visit before previously. And since then, we've taken so many trips to all of these different areas of France. And I mean, I had visited quite a bit. I had visited the Loire, I had visited, you know, the Basque region. You know, it's not like I had never been outside of Paris. I'd been to Normandy. But the more we're able to take these little mini trips away from Paris during all of these wonderful school vacation periods that we have, the more I feel like I'm able to really enjoy covering all these different areas. And like I said, now I have the budget to experience some of these more interesting food opportunities. We have clients now who are all over France, from Brittany to Nice and Cannes to the Western coast. Like we have some clients in Bordeaux. Like we literally have clients everywhere. I could go on a business trip to pretty much any city I want and write it off. So that's great too. And yeah, it's just, you know, it's been so crafting. And just like every time I visit a new place, I love France a little bit more.
Yeah, it really is. You know, it's funny because I feel like a lot of people have like some love-hate relationship with France. And I've actually never really experienced that. Like even when it's really hard to like do the admin and all of that, I just look at it as like part of the game. You know, you have to have a little bit of pain in order to have pleasure, right? It's like this kind of thing.
Very French. That is very French.
Yes, I have integrated that. I have learned to integrate that. And but you're right. I mean, being able to travel around this country is really, really rewarding. And what's great too is that you don't just have to come to France in the summer. And I think a lot of people, when they imagine coming to France, they imagine it in the summertime. And actually, there's so, like, every single season of the year has its moment, right? And like has its spot. So, I mean, if you're coming in the summer, obviously going to the south of France, it's really beautiful, but there's a lot of people, right? And so like the south of France in spring or in fall is phenomenal because you get the great weather, you get the sunshine, but you get less people. And then winter time, I mean, you go to the extreme west and east, and like winter in Alsace is incredible because you have all of the Christmas markets. It smells like, you know, chestnuts, all sorts of great stuff. Sausages, because I'm from Wisconsin, so, you know, I love the smell of a sausage. What are you going to do? And then in the winter as well, cognac. people don't think about going to visit Cognac, but actually it's a wine producing region, but they also make this spirit that's only distilled in the wintertime. So the only time that you can really experience like the process of making cognac is actually to go in the winter. And yeah, so it's really, really cool. And what I also love about France is that like every single region that you want to visit pretty much is also wine producing. So there's always good food. There's always good wine.
Yeah, you can't go wrong.
Yeah, you really can't go wrong. Yeah, that's, you know, it's great.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think in terms of, you know, what you said about having that love-hate relationship, especially with some of the bureaucracy or the admin or like just kind of getting used to the cultural differences, I kind of think, I tend to think of it more about like being in a relationship with France and, you know, every person that you could potentially be in a whatever type of relationship has their qualities that you absolutely adore about them and their kind of annoying quirks. And you just have to decide how much you're willing to tolerate them and how annoying they actually are to you.
It's a lesson in like patience. I mean, I would say patience is the biggest. Yeah, patience, endurance, like living in France takes a lot of these qualities, but you're right. It really, yeah, perseverance. It is being in a relationship for sure. And like, you kind of just choose to ignore the parts or you block them out of your memory, basically. I mean, all of us have, you know, very annoying admin moments, and you just kind of have to, there comes a moment where you just block it out of your mind. You know, I mean, you know, it happened. You can be realistic about that, but if you're going to keep, you know, a positive attitude and stay sane, you just kind of need to block it out.
Yeah. And you can forgive France and just console yourself with wine and cheese.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. The good outweighs the bad for sure.
Yeah. Talk about for a minute, what made you feel like you were ready to become French and what that process was like.
So, I mean, a lot of it was, I didn't want to have to deal with getting a visa every year anymore. I mean, that was, you know, that was getting real old. I mean, I had been here for 9 years, and every single year I had to go to the préfecture and I had to like get all my documents together because of course nothing is digitized, even though it's the exact same things from year to year. You're still putting the same stuff together.
Happy to report that that has slightly improved and that now it is online and digital and you don't have to go every year, but it's still kind of terrible.
Yeah, my period was not, but that was not the case. So, I mean, thank you, COVID, for pushing France to like be a little bit more organized digitally, right? Like that's probably part of it too. But yeah, I guess what really kind of inspired me is that everything I do is really related to France, right? I mean, I work in museums. I mean, I'm in the Louvre twice a week. I'm hanging out at the Musée d'Orsay all the time. I'm doing tours of Montmartre. I'm taking people to Burgundy. I'm heading off to Bordeaux. And, you know, once you're doing all these things, you're kind of like, but everything I do is related to France. And in fact, like, you know, I'm hungry to like learn everything about this country. And so at some point I was just kind of like, I mean, I'm sick of doing all of the paperwork all the time. And literally, there is nothing I could do anywhere else in the world because everything that I do is related to France. Everything. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what I would do if I would move back to the States, like do French wine tastings again.
Yeah, probably. Somebody asked me about that. We just did a questionnaire for like our social media people. And they were one of the questions. They were like, if you could have any other career, what would you do? And I was like, wouldn't. Like,
yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, everything I do is super fun. I mean, I get to meet new people all the time. I get to like, you know, discover these different products all the time. I get to learn about art all the time. I mean, yeah, I don't get bored. So essentially that's kind of what motivated me to get my French citizenship is a combination of being annoyed at doing paperwork and really like loving what I do and really loving this country and love living here. So, you know, I also, there comes a moment where you're kind of like, well, I also want to be able to participate as a citizen in the place where I live. I want to be able to vote. I want to be able to do these things where like, you know, I mean, they also impact my life. So yeah, I mean, I went through the whole citizen process and it was actually not too bad because I did it over COVID. So got my, you know, file together, sent it off. And of course, I mean, there was something wrong with it. So it got sent back, obviously. But then, you know,
the final hurdle.
Yeah, the final hurdle of just like convincing. But this is what I'm talking about with like moral harassment and perseverance. Like if something's wrong and you don't understand, you just have to keep calling every 2 minutes until you get the person who gives you the answer you want on the phone. So there's that. So, you know, my dossier went fine. Everything got through. And then you have to do the interview, right? And I have heard so many horror stories about the interviews. I mean, one of my friends, they like bombarded her with questions about French athletes. And I was like, oh my God, if they ask me about like French athletes, I'm just gonna, yeah. I'm just gonna fail.
Mbappe is the only like, one that I can identify.
Yeah, I'm like Mbappe, Chabal, or whatever his name is, the like rugby player who looks like a horse, and like the word for horse is Chabal. So it's Chabal, you know, I mean, whatever. It's okay. Those yeah. things where I was like, I got two. That's the end, right? But then they actually, my interview process was super funny. They bombarded me with a barrage of questions about, you know, the rivers, the regions, all these historical figures. And I was like, I work in wine and history. Like, I know all this stuff already. And I was like, this is great. So it was rapid fire questioning. It became like a game with the woman who was interviewing me. She was like, how fast can you respond to these questions? And so it was really funny. But then she asked me about the four pillars of French society, right? So we all know liberty, equality, fraternity, but then there's the fourth, which is cité. So secularism. And she like hammered me with questions about laïcité and the concept of it. And if I, you know, adhered to that value, and oh yeah, that was intense, but otherwise it went, you know, totally fine, and got my citizenship. And it was really cool because I had applied over COVID. I actually got my citizenship right after the country was opening up. And I was among the first people to like have a big celebration and like a big ceremony again for becoming French. So my French citizens like ceremony was actually at the Opera de Paris in
oh
so,
my God.
So you're like, you know, you go into the opera house, they have all of these like chairs and a stage set up in one of the like beautiful halls in and they had all of the kind of like musicians and singers all like playing music and fanfare when we first walked in. And then, you know, a French person, a French opera singer. Well, no, it was actually, sorry, that's not true. It was a woman from maybe Brazil or something who became French and was an opera singer at the opera house. And she like sang the, so like, it was really, really awesome. And I was like, this is what it is to be French. Like, this is so cool. Yeah, that was really fun. Mm.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was a great experience. All of my other friends that became citizens over COVID, like, got a letter in the mail, and that was the end.
Yeah, yeah.
So I applied at the right time, apparently.
Yeah, clearly you had magical timing. Mm.
This is the thing. The French say you're born under a good star. And yeah, that seems.
Yeah.
Seemed to be the case. Yeah.
So tell me about, let's go back to sort of when you first got to Paris and some of the things that you've done other than work. So we actually met, we were both singing with a choir back in the day.
Two choirs.
Voices, two choirs, right. Two choirs, because there was
two choirs.
Young adult choir at the American Church and Voices Chœur International, which both of which were directed by Bonnie Woolley, who I think is now in Dubai.
That's about right.
So, but she lived in France for quite a long time. And what were some of the things that you did when you first got here to, I don't know, make friends, not just with other Americans, but also with French people? Like, how did you start feeling like you were active in the community and like you were sort of creating a life here and establishing yourself long-term in ways that didn't necessarily have to do with work?
Well, I mean, obviously Voices was a huge thing. Like being in that choir was so great because it was such a good mix of people kind of from all over the world. I mean, probably what, 50% yeah. was French, 30% was American. And then it was kind of, you know, a smattering of other
yeah, there was like a German woman. There was a like guy from either maybe Serbia. There were a couple of British people. Yeah, they were really from all over. I think we were the babies of the choir because we were both in our early 20s at the time. And I think everybody else was like over 50.
Yes, maybe over 60.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
No, there were a couple of other women who were like in their 30s or early 40s. And like one of them moved back to the US and one of them moved out to the country. And so then it was just kind of us and everybody else.
Yeah, true. Well, what's really,
but everybody
what's
really was funny, lovely. Everybody, I really loved all the people in that choir. Yeah, everybody was great.
That choir was just such a good mix of people. And like, also I mean, I've never been somebody to just want to hang out with people that are my age. I mean, I've always really loved, you know, having younger people around me, older people around me, just because, you know, I mean, everybody can bring something to the table. And yeah, I've just never had that. Maybe it's being like an only child as well. I don't know. It just kind of, I was like in my 20s and I'm like, I just need to be around adults.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was not an only child, but I always only wanted to hang out with grown-ups. I never wanted to hang out with other kids.
An older spirit. Yeah.
I was like one of those old soul kind of people when I was a kid.
Yeah. Fair. No, but that was actually a huge thing for me because everybody had different types of jobs. Everybody had different experiences. And basically, you know, I mean, all of us became really great friends. And so even from that choir, I mean, two of the guys that really stand out to me, well, three of the guys are like two guys, well, Dan, Robin, and Dana. And what's amazing is all of them were, you know, in their 50s or 60s. A lot of them like worked in art, architecture. And so through that network, I ended up becoming a production assistant in a movie for one of them that they were directing at one point. And then the other guy, like when I was buying my apartment, he helped me figure out all of these like architecture things and could like break down to me like what was happening in the apartment and would like help me go through all of the documents, which when you're buying a house or an apartment in Paris is like, there's a lot of documents and it's very confusing. And a lot of them go back to like 1934 and you're like, I don't know what's happening. And so he helped me walk through that. And then, you know, I mean, yeah, they just became really, a lot of those people just became really great friends. And even now, I mean, I even though we're not singing together anymore, we still stay in touch. I do still sing with two of the girls that were in that choir. I mean, we mostly just like chat and drink, but every once in a while we sing a song. And yeah, so it's super cool. That kind of thing is really, really important. I think when you move to a new country is to really, you know, develop a network of people that you can trust. And that's a little bit diverse. So, I mean, what's interesting is obviously now there's a lot of like Facebook groups. I mean, that didn't exist when we moved to France, right? So I think, you know, social media now for new people coming to France is so great. And I know there's so many Facebook groups out there about pretty much anything that you want to do. And that's a great way of meeting new people. And I mean, I got really lucky because the first job that I had in France, well, I had a couple of different jobs all at once, but one of them was working as a tour guide where I met a lot of other people who are tour guides, which is a great network. Everybody's super interesting. People are doing conferences all the time about, you know, new galleries that are opening or new exhibitions that are on. So that's really enriching. And then, I mean, this still has to do with jobs, but what are you going to do? But working at a university was really great because everybody at a university is super international. So, I mean, a lot of my good friends that are still here, I met at that job, but they're Australian, they're British, they're German, you know, I mean, it's kind of all over the board. And then, yeah, like that was a lot of how I met people. And oh, this is also a little weird, but for a while, a lot of the people that I were hanging out with were actually people that I met on online dating who just kind of became friends. And that was really cool. I got to go into the illegal parts of the catacombs. I hope
I remember when I did that.
Yeah, I already have my French citizenship, so they're not going to revoke it for this. But yeah, no, I went into a manhole with someone on an OkCupid date with a group. It wasn't just him.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds dangerous. Don't do that alone.
Yeah. No, but like basically, yeah, like Medi was like, oh, it's our second date and I have a friend who's a cataphile. Like, let's go into the catacombs with him. I'm like, okay. So, I mean, that was like a really cool way to meet people in a very illegal setting, but maybe I shouldn't share that too much. I was young, right?
And I think the statute of limitations on that particular bêtise has expired.
Yes, that particular, yes, you are correct. It is expired. It is fine. I can say it now. But yeah, I mean, you know, it depends on your attitude with things like, you know, meetup apps and stuff like that. But I mean, my attitude was always, I'm just like going to have a drink with somebody. So it's like not, there's no pressure, like who cares, right? And that actually worked out a lot. Yeah, had some pretty great friends from that. I mean, we've lost touch since, unfortunately, but that happens too.
Yeah.
Cool. Hopefully that answered your question.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the things that you kind of touched on when we were singing in that choir, like it was people of all different ages in all different areas, like architect, there was a woman who worked for like the UN. There were a couple of people from the OECD. Like, there's a woman who's a translator. Like, they're all different people in all different kinds of careers. And so one of the other things that I thought was really cool about that particular group was you could really see the people who had been here for a long time and the different things that they had done. And it was an introduction to, like,
what your life could be.
How cool. Right. What your life could be. Like, what are the cool things that everybody was involved with? And then there were some people who would come and, like, join for a year or two. And, you know, they were students and they were there temporarily and stuff like that. But the people who had been there, who had been the heart of the choir, which existed, I think, for over 20 years when we first started. And I don't know what they're doing now, if they're still around, but.
Yeah, it's one of the, you know, I mean, it really, I think there's a thing as well when you first move to a new country, or even when you move to a new city, right? There's like a whole learning process of, like, figuring out how the city works, what kinds of people have been there, like what your opportunities are. And essentially, you know, I think just being really open to meeting different people, to putting yourself into, you know, situations where you're not necessarily in your comfort zone 100% is just really, really important, because you never know what opportunity is going to come up. And if you don't take a risk, I mean, it's already a risk moving to another country, right? But then, right, you know, you have to put in all this other work to not be scared. And you just kind of have to try out lots of different things until you kind of slide into your place within that new environment, right? And I think it's a thing, just being open to everything all the time is a great way to find your spot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was a huge risk for me when I quit teaching at the university and joined the Cordon Bleu, because I mean, I could have failed massively at that job. I mean, at the beginning of that job, it was horrifying. I mean, I was in front of 20 students who had paid 20 grand for the year, and I didn't know anything about wine, and I was supposed to be the vector of knowledge for them because they didn't speak French. Like, that was a huge weight on my shoulders. And like, I was exhausted for like months just trying to like learn all of this vocabulary, trying to understand the way that French sommeliers talk about wine, which is very different from the way that sommeliers in America talk about wine. It's much more artsy. It's more like looking at an impressionist painting rather than looking at a realist painting, right? And it was super stressful and terrible. And at one point, like, the students were like, you know, it was like 3 weeks in, they were like, just fire her, get someone new, she's terrible at it. And then, you know, 3 months in, they were like, no, like, let's go get a drink, like, this is great. But yeah, I mean, you know, that was, it was a huge risk. And it was really mentally challenging and exhausting to do that. But had I not taken that risk and not persevered, I wouldn't be where I was today. You know, I mean, last week it was the best sommelier of the world competition. And I mean, I've been on Team France that helps prepare the person for these competitions for the last like 6 years. And I would have never been there if I hadn't persevered through the Cordon Bleu, you know? I mean, obviously my role is not necessarily teaching them how to taste, right? I mean, all of these competitions are in English. So essentially I'm kind of their English support system, help challenge them on their English, get them to talk faster, clearer, all these things. But I mean, I have to know what they're talking about. And, you know, being on that team is really, really rewarding and really, really cool. So, I mean, yeah, you have to take a lot of risks. And like, if you're not feeling uncomfortable most of the time, I don't know what's going to happen, you know?
Yeah, I know exactly. I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. And I mean, that's one of the things that I always really admired about you, like even back from when we first started becoming friends, was that, you know, you were always so like enthusiastic and like kind of up for anything, like, let's just try it and see how it goes. And I think that's a really admirable and important quality to have, like when you move to a new place and when you're trying all these new things and trying to figure out what you're going to do with your life. And I don't know, I haven't yet reached a point where I'm, you know, I don't know if you ever like stop trying to figure out what you're going to do with your life. Like, I don't know if there's an end point to that process at some point. And yeah, I think the more you can just kind of look at everything as an experiment and an impressionist painting and enjoy the food and wine along the way, the more fun you're going to have and the more you're able to do.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because like my like I suppose like life vision in a lot of ways is what's the worst that can happen?
Yeah.
Right. Like, I mean, what's the worst that can happen is you fail, but then you just do something else. Right. Or like, what's the worst that can happen if you, you know, I mean, I always think that I don't like andouille, which is not andouille sausage from America. It is just, it smells like poop. It tastes like poop. It's gross. Like andouille is not my thing. But what's funny is every single time somebody orders andouille, I'm like, can I taste it? Because maybe at some point I'm just going to like it. You know, yeah. I think it's the only thing that I'm kind of a little adverse to. I mean, I'm definitely not going to order it for myself, but I'm constantly trying to taste it and thinking like, oh, like maybe my palate will have evolved to like that. Because obviously maybe a lot of other people like it, you know, and it's like, what's the worst that can happen? I mean, I'll have eaten something that I didn't enjoy, but then, you know, I can just go and eat something else right afterwards and get that weird taste out of my mouth, hopefully within the next like 20 minutes.
Right.
You know?
And I mean, that's what I tell my kid. You know, like try it. You might like it this time. So why wouldn't it work for?
Yeah, exactly. Like what is the worst that can happen? You'll have a bad taste in your mouth for 20 minutes. Or like, what's the worst that you can that can happen? I mean, you'll fail. And then 3 months later, you'll have another opportunity and like, you'll pick yourself back up and like, you'll be good.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, ebbs and flows of everything. Bad
taste, right. And sometimes the bad taste in your mouth and the failure is a gift that brings you to something better. Like the things that I've learned the most from were things like, you know, being able to pivot during COVID, and the things that I failed the most at in starting my business and growing my business have been the things that have inspired me to create certain things that, you know, make things, you know, make the whole business way better later.
Well, yeah, because you're constantly learning from your, I mean, if you're not failing, you're not growing and you're not learning things. So, right. I mean, totally. I mean, honestly, some of the worst moments that I've had have been things where I'm going through some sort of growing pain, right? So working at the Cordon Bleu, the first couple of months were a huge growing pain. When I first moved to France and was living in Burgundy and living in a house that I didn't know the people, right? I mean, you're living at the host family. They have totally different ways of like just navigating life, right? That was also a horrible experience because, I mean, I had to learn French basically like a baby from nothing because I spoke, the only French I knew was from the talking heads, you know? Like, I mean, that was it. Right. And then maybe like a little bit of a bonjour every once in a while. And like my accent was terrible. And I didn't know what was happening. And like the first 5 months of living in Burgundy was awful. It was horrendous. Yeah. I felt so isolated and alone. But at the same time, like clearly I loved the suffering and just decided to like keep moving back to France. And that suffering was just like, it was a growing pain that I just had to like get through. And then it was like the most rewarding thing that I'd done, you know? Yeah. And literally like those are kind of like the two of the toughest, you know, probably like the toughest moments that I've had, like me, it was just tiring. And turns out being tiring, you know, is something when you're tired, I mean, you're not at your best, you know? And and like, that was it. I mean, I have found parenting not nearly as difficult as those two moments. I thought parenting was going to be terrible. I thought it was going to be another one of those moments, and it's actually not, you know, for me anyway. It's probably not the case for everyone, but it's, you know, it's a funny thing. Like you really do have to grow and learn, make mistakes, because you're right. Like you don't do better if you're not doing things wrong. You need to be able to like fix stuff, pivot, make things better for clients. You know, when people have a bad experience, I don't know, with like a restaurant, for example, you learn and you do better.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But yeah, I mean, the whole package of living in France, I mean, moving to a new country, operating in a new language, there are just so many challenges and opportunities for personal growth.
And it's very, very rewarding when you succeed.
It is. It is. And another thing I was thinking about too is sometimes, especially when we have like failures in language or failures to communicate, and it's tricky, and like you use the wrong word, or you say something stupid or whatever, some of your best moments of connection can come out of that too. You know, like if you're really okay with being silly or stupid occasionally, and you know, don't, close up and get embarrassed after the mistake, and you stay open to whatever happens next, and like, okay, what should I have said? Oh, that's so funny. Like, you know, well, let's figure it out. Like, you can have some really good conversations and experiences with people after things like
oh,
that.
Oh yeah. Well, and you know, I mean, I've come to the thing as well, like my French is by far, like, it's not perfect. There is nothing great about my French. But what's funny is like my comprehension is really great, which is why I can be an interpreter, right? I mean, I can understand what everybody's saying perfectly and like a lot of the nuance and all that, right? So my interpreting from French to English is fine. My interpreting from English to French is much to be desired. Yeah. But most of that has to do with the fact that like I didn't really take any French grammar classes. And so for me, like French grammar, I'm just kind of like, whatever, it's just like more rules that I need to follow. And like, it's just too much for me. And so like, I can't do gender. It is like the biggest joke with all my French friends. They're like, you've literally made no progress in gender. You have been here for so long. And I'm like, what is gender? You know, I mean, I think we can just get over that at this point. Yeah. Like, you understand what I'm saying. Like, does it really matter? And, you know, it's funny because they're like, yes, it does actually matter. This is the language of Molière. And I'm like, well, I mean, this is my language. We all have our own way of interpreting things. So I'm just going to do it how I want. And then, you know, my other response is, well, I already speak the language of Shakespeare, who's much more well-known than Molière. So,
well, that's fair enough. Yeah. There, in Sarah Donnelly, who does the show, The Only American in Paris, I went to see it a couple months ago, and she was an earlier podcast episode. And one of the moments in her show, she does this little bit where she's talking about, you know, she's something's happening with her child, her daughter, who's very young, and like, I think the daughter's screaming in her poussette, and she's talking about, like, you know, this older woman comes out to like make sure she's not kidnapping the baby, basically, and she's like, je suis le maman, and the woman is like, I don't understand a thing you're saying because you didn't get the article right. And like, sometimes it can be like that a little bit.
My God, exhausting. So, but I mean,
sentence right in the complex structure, and then like you don't get the grammatical gender correct, and therefore like nobody can understand a thing that you're saying, and that happens sometimes. But
I mean, it's better if you can do the genders, obviously. I am not telling anyone to follow my lead on this, because it's better if you can speak French perfectly, because they'll take you more seriously. But you know, I mean, at this point, as long as you don't lose your cool, you can really just mess it up all the time. But if you're like, you know, getting really emotional and using the wrong gender, you just kind of sound like an idiot. So, you know,
sound like idiots sometimes. And
exactly.
You know.
So I do my best when I'm dealing with French admin to be like, listen to my like cute, funny accent. Like, I really try not to lose my cool and like let them hear my smile on the other side of the telephone. You know, it's like, it's that kind of thing. And that way, you know, usually it works out pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without having to learn the genders, because my brain just cannot, it can only, you know, it can only absorb so much. And
think that holding on to all of the important wine information is probably far more essential.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in between wine, art. I mean, both of these worlds are insanely rich, and there's so much to learn. And for me, you know, most of what I'm doing is in English. So just going to focus on that and not worry about French grammar.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, it's relieving as well, because, you know, if you can learn the grammar as you go along.
Right.
You don't have to feel like you need to be perfect right away. You know, it's just put yourself out there, give it a go. Most of the time they'll understand you. Yeah, I've got a friend visiting right now, and he went into, you know, he went into like order a sandwich, and he was like, you know, sandwich? And essentially I was like, right. I mean, you know what? I bet they're probably going to understand. I'm not going to correct it. And like, literally, you know, I mean, the sandwich woman was like, okay, well, I got it. I think I got it. You're okay.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, sandwich hambone. She's like, okay, right. You want a ham sandwich? Great. We're good. And I'm like, yeah, that's right. That's right, lady. Don't correct him. You got what he was saying. I like it. Because French people love correcting, you know.
Yeah. I think that's one of the five love languages of France.
Yeah. Telling correcting. You that you're wrong and fixing it.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. There might be two different categories of like correcting your French and explaining things to you about how life should be, like what you should eat for breakfast, the appropriate time that you can drink your coffee, you know, things like that, that are obviously subject to strict rules and not personal interpretation.
Yeah. I mean, I know I've heard this a lot from parents and dog owners as well, where like, you know, I mean, people will just come up to you and tell you all the things that you're doing wrong with your child or your dog. I haven't had this so much with a kid, but with my dog, it isn't. Because I mean, he is very handsome. I mean, my dog is very handsome. Not to, you know, toot his own horn, but yeah, he's great. And, you know, he's like, he's a big, burly golden retriever. And, you know, golden retrievers, their tongue hangs out all the time and like they're panting all over the place. I cannot tell you the number of times that some like 8-year-old woman has been like, your dog's thirsty. And I'm like, my dog is always thirsty. I don't need you to tell me that. And they're like, don't you have any water? And I'm like, I am literally 4 steps out of my house, madam. Like, no, I did not bring water with me. He's going to pee and he's going to go back home and he is going to drink some water. He is going to be just fine. And yeah, it's all the time. Or like, oh, is he going to burn his feet on the ground? And I'm like, no, it's 10 at night. That's why I'm bringing him out at 10 at night. There's no sun out. It's not hot out there anymore. It's okay. Oh yeah. Or like, oh, your kid's not wearing a hat. And I'm like, I mean, I could put a hat on my kid, but he doesn't like wearing hats and he is going to scream all over the place. So no. He's just not wearing a hat. That's not his jam. Yeah. Like, I don't need your advice if he's wearing, he's got a hood on. He's all right.
His mother is from Wisconsin. He's going to be fine.
Yeah.
He's
got like that tough Wisconsin cold blood in him. He's all right.
Yeah. My son only wears short sleeve t-shirts. So he refuses to wear long sleeves. Has never worn, I think maybe like 3 days in his life. I have gotten him since he was old enough to express his opinion on such things. Have I gotten him to wear a long sleeve t-shirt? So yeah, I get comments all the time about how cold he must be. I'm like, I'm from Boston. People where I come from, like boys where I come from, wear shorts and flip-flops in the winter and walk through 3 feet of snow carrying an iced coffee from Dunkin' Donuts. He's going to be okay.
Yep. It's going to be
but of course, we live in a very diverse neighborhood where there are a lot of families where the parents are from like North Africa or West Africa or different places where obviously the climate is much different and they're not used to, you know, once it gets below 20 degrees Celsius or about, what's that, 65 maybe degrees Fahrenheit, you know, they're all bundled up and their kids are all bundled up in winter coats and scarves and hats and all of that stuff. And that's just not, I don't need that. You know, Grant doesn't need that, but
yeah,
everybody has a different point.
But I mean, the French in general tend to be a little bit like they're always chilled, right? I went on a road trip with a couple of friends and one of them was French and it was like, you know, it's super hot out and we put the air conditioning on in the car and she was like, oh no, I forgot my scarf. And I was like, excuse me? She's like, yeah, I need to put on my scarf because otherwise my neck is going to get cold. And I was like, oh.
Yeah, and then you're going to get sick from the air conditioner. Yep. That was actually, I've been watching Emily in Paris. I've been catching up with that over the weekend. And that was one of the things. There's like an episode where it's really hot. And the character Luke is like, oh, but we can't put the air conditioner on. Well, there's no air conditioner in the office because it would make us all sick.
Yeah.
And that is a very French thing.
Yes, it is. So it's really funny. And I actually just got air conditioning installed in my apartment and I am very happy about that. So yeah, no, it's there's certain things that Emily in Paris brings up that actually are very truthful. So
I'm a big fan. Yeah, I'm a big fan of that show. I think there's a lot of things in there that are extra funny if you are an American in Paris and have lived through a lot of those things. And
not being able to find light switches. That's real. Yes. That's still real to me. I can't find half of the light switches when I go into a new building. I'm like, I'm just going to have to use my phone to walk up all these like 6 flights of stairs because I don't know where the light switches are. Or you're like ringing people's doorbells and you thought that they were lights and you're like, oh my God, I'm sorry. Old women coming out in their slippers and they're like, what do you want? And I'm like, oh, I'm not Jehovah's Witness. I'm sorry. Like,
just want to see.
Yeah. Just trying to find the light. And they're like, you stupid person, it's right here. And I'm like, oh, well, that was hidden behind a pipe. So no, I didn't find that. Sorry. Yeah.
This has been so much fun. Do you have any advice for somebody who might want to move to France?
Well, I would say, you know, using Allison's services is probably a great idea so that you don't have to go through all of the hurdles alone. That's, you know, a top thing. Because, I mean, you know, we got to France at the same time. So essentially we were like navigating the system yeah. together and, you know, navigating them separately. Cause like, obviously we had different needs, different jobs and things like that too. So yeah, I would say, you know, try to get a base of people who can help you get through the system if you can. That way you don't have to struggle through it alone. And it will probably take a lot less time as well. Also, I mean, really like what we talked about earlier, like being really open to yeah. different opportunities and kind of not assuming that you're going to dislike something. Mm. I think go into everything that's like new in France with the idea that you're going to love what you're doing, you know, yeah. like trying new foods. I mean, if you don't like raw oysters, yeah, maybe you don't like raw oysters, but there's no harm in giving it another shot like once a year, you know? So it's
just, in a month that has an R in it.
Very, very important. I did a TikTok video about that. So yeah, my TikTok is really, you know, where it's at. You can learn all the fun okay. facts. Yeah. So yeah, being open, trying new things, not being scared. I mean, even if you are scared, psych yourself out and think that you're not.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be okay.
Yeah. It's going to be all right. That would be my advice. And okay, like cool. drink as much wine as possible.
Yes. Try all the wine and all the
good, cheaper. Good and bad. You're yeah. never going to appreciate great wine if you haven't had a lot of bad wine.
Wise words to live by.
Yep. That's me validating pretty much the majority of my 20s. So
great. Well, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thanks, Allison.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Profiles in France Formation with Allison Grant Luness. If you liked this episode, please like, subscribe, and share on social media. I'll see you next time for a new episode, and in the meantime, I hope we've inspired you today to pursue your dreams, no matter how big or small. Remember, the way you bring your own dreams into reality is by believing in yourself and taking small steps towards your goal. Start today, start now, and à bientôt.